This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Welcome along. Here it is then, what we've all waited for, another glistening new episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name's Dan, and if you're like me, if you're amazed and you're baffled why you're on this planet right now, and if you're curious about everything weird, wild and wonderful that's in the universe all around you, this is the show for you. We try and get the answers to all of those questions. In today's show, we'll discover how the computer was invented. Also, in a sec, we'll chat to a person who's in the running to win a one-way ticket to Mars. And in today's weekly Dangerous Dan feature, we'll learn about the most painful sting known to man. First, we're jumping into the past to learn about some brutal beasts from history with the Age of the Dinosaurs.
Travel back in time to the Age of the Dinosaur
at the Natural History Museum.
Imagine going back in time, not 100 years, or 1,000 years, but millions of years. To the Age of the Dinosaur. Welcome to the Cretaceous period, which existed between 65 and 144 million years ago. More varieties of animals and plants lived than ever before. From the dinosaur on the land to the plants they ate, things were getting pretty busy underwater too. Dinosaurs didn't go into the oceans, but that didn't mean they were empty. Far from it. Much of the sea life from the Jurassic period remained, including Ichthyosaurus, agile dolphin-like creatures, as well as starfish and ammonites, soft shellfish with long streaming tentacles.
Wow, he's massive! Let's get out of this way.
He certainly is. Some Cretaceous ammonites were enormous, as much as 2 meters in diameter, and much bigger than their Jurassic relatives. Along with these older creatures, new types of fish were appearing, the ancestors of those we find in our seas today. These included rays, flatfish with wing-like fins, and teleosts. Bony fish, not so different to the cod you get in the chip shop.
Uh-oh, that looks like a shark to me.
The wide variety of life made the oceans an attractive place for predators. Sharks, like those seen today, battled alongside much larger plesiosaurs, powerful reptiles with large flippers and a long neck. But towards the end of the Cretaceous period, a terrifying predator ruled. The mosasaur. Here comes one now!
Let's get out of here. He's way scarier than a shark.
Mosasaurs look like streamlined lizards. Their short paddle-like limbs and powerful tails were ideal for fast swimming, enabling them to pounce underwater at prey. Smaller specimens crunched on sea urchins and mollusks, while the largest variety, some 17 meters long, preyed on birds, fish and reptiles, and even other mosasaurs. Mosasaurs had a double-hinged jaw and flexible skull, much like a snake, which meant they could almost gulp down their prey whole. Again, just like snakes or Komodo dragons.
Paleontology. Pick.
How do we know what the world looked like millions of years ago?
Scientists piece together evidence from fossils using lots of different techniques, including microscopes to look at tiny details and CT scanners to peer inside. They record information about where a fossil was found, examine its surroundings, look at what animals ate, and compare fossils to similar animals alive today, like comparing the mosasaurs to snakes. Computers are used to take this data and create models, from simple black and white pictures to exciting moving animated monsters. Travel back in time to the Age of the Dinosaur.
The new interactive exhibition at the Natural History Museum. Walk alongside life-size moving animatronic dinosaurs and other strange creatures among the smells and sounds of the prehistoric Jurassic swamps and Cretaceous deserts. Find out more at nhm.ac.uk.
But watch out for what's around the corner.
You can get the rest of our Age of Dinosaurs series for free on your phone or tablet. Just download them through iTunes, through the Fun Kids app, and over at funkidslive.com. We'll be on the phone with a man who is getting ready for a one-way ticket to Mars in just a sec. First, I want to say a huge hello to Alfie Wilson. Alfie is 5. He loves the show. He's a massive fan of Dangerous Dan as well. And he's left a message and a review on iTunes to tell everyone else that he's loving it. Thank you so much, Alfie. Right, stay right there, mate, okay? Really soon, we'll have today's Dangerous Dan, where we'll learn about a tiny creature that causes a whole load of pain. And I know you're going to like that. By the way, if you want a shout-out on this show, it's dead easy, right? All you need to do is get hold of a phone or tablet, open up the iTunes podcast store on there, and then leave us a review. Say what you like about the show, tell everyone else why you're loving it, tell us your name as well, drop us some stars, then I can see it, I can know you're there, and I can say hello next week. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Today we've got a man who possibly might get the most important job in the history of the world. He's down to the last 100 applicants to be a Mars One astronaut. His name is Ryan McDonald. He's on the phone. How are you doing, Ryan?
I'm doing very well today. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. So you're in the running to get a one-way ticket to Mars. Can you tell us more about what's going on?
Yeah, sure. So a few years ago, I applied for a mission to Mars, which was being organised not by a government, but actually by a company, hoping to send people to go and live on Mars, not just to visit, in the year 2031. And this was perhaps the most popular job application in history. Over 200,000 people applied for it at the beginning. And now we're down to just 100 around the world. So it's an incredibly exciting time, as I look forward to potentially having the chance to be one of the first people to go to Mars and, as a scientist, explore it and find out what the red planet is really like.
So if you're down to the last 100, why do you think you've made the cut? What is it that's so special about you that people think you might be able to colonise a planet and maybe save our species?
So I think that perhaps one of the most important traits that I've demonstrated up to this point in the selection process has been the ability to rapidly learn and acquire new skills and then apply them in unfamiliar situations. So it doesn't actually matter for a Mars mission what you know. You could already know how stars work and about astrophysics, which is my own field of research, but that doesn't help you to do dentistry, for instance. It doesn't help you necessarily to repair a generator when it's broken. So you have to be able to learn things fast. And that is what I think I've demonstrated up to this point.
So down to the last 100, what do you need to do now to be selected to actually go?
Up to this point, Mars One has just been testing us as individual people. So they've been testing how smart we are. They've been testing how we think and how we feel. But if you want to go to Mars, you have to be able to get on really well in a group. So we now have 10 groups of 10 candidates that have been organised and put together. And next year, we're going to be going through a series of challenges to assess how we work together in teams. And then we'll also spend about 9 days locked up in what's called an isolation chamber to see how we cope with being in extreme isolation. So that's what will be coming up next year.
So, right, you're selected now, Ryan, we're going to say. You've flown up there 7 months or something that it's taken you to travel from Earth to the Red Planet. You've just landed. It's day one of a brand new colony. What are you doing? What's the first day like?
So it might actually take as long as 48 hours before you finally got your legs ready to walk. But once you are at that point, then you will, actually one of the rovers of the settlement will drive out to meet us where we land, because it's quite hard to land on Mars accurately. So you might land maybe 5 miles or so away from the settlement. So you get picked up by the rover, you get driven to the settlement, which is already built beforehand by robotic missions that Mars One will send over the years beforehand, the first week, because your body's not quite used to being back on a planet with gravity again. Once you've settled in, there's a lot of construction work, there's maintenance to be done, and ultimately it's getting all of the things ready and established so that you're then ready to go to get stuck into the great science that we'll be able to do over the first few years of the mission.
What is the great science that you're hoping to do?
Well, personally, one of the great questions that really has dominated and fascinated my own scientific career is whether there's life elsewhere in the universe. We know nowadays that Mars used to be a much more hospitable place than it is now. It used to have lakes, rivers, and oceans on the surface, but they're not there anymore. Mars is now a very cold planet, and all the water seems to be frozen at the ice caps. So what we'd like to know is, did Mars have life in the distant past many billions of years ago? And potentially, could there still be life maybe beneath the surface? To answer that question, we need to send trained scientists to the surface. And that is the question that we're going to try and answer.
So yourself and the other people that are hopefully going to go up there, obviously some of the greatest scientific minds that we have on the Earth right now. So why can't you stay here and use all your knowledge to save the planet that we're on? I'm just, is it not a bit smug of humans that we need to kind of go elsewhere and find other planets to live on rather than just kind of help the one that we're on right now?
Well, actually, in many ways, by going to Mars, we will actually learn ways to help the Earth. There are technologies that we'll develop, for example, more efficient solar panels that we will need for a Martian outpost that have direct applications back here on the Earth. And actually, I would argue that perhaps one of the biggest reasons to send people to Mars is the inspirational effect. Following the Apollo moon missions, the amount of people studying science at university pretty much doubled in the United States in the following 10 years. All of the people that are excited and inspired to grow up and become scientists and engineers because of, in that case, the moon landings, and in this case, the Mars landings, will directly go on to tackle all of the huge problems that we face right here on the Earth. So I'm not arguing we should neglect the Earth in favor of Mars. In many ways, by exploring Mars, we'll come up with new and exciting ways to help protect the Earth and make life better for everyone.
Now, Mars, to me, it's always been quite an evil planet. I don't know, because it's red, because it seems so barren and looks so mean and nasty. What are the most dangerous things that you're expecting to come across on your way there and also when you're on the red planet?
So when you're on your way to Mars, one of the things that you really have to worry about is explosions on the surface of the sun that we call coronal mass ejections. When one of these takes place, it sends a huge wave of particles towards us that, if you don't go into a dedicated radiation shelter, you'll probably end up getting cancer because of it. And so we estimate that about two of these will probably happen along the way to Mars. And so you have to hide inside a hollowed out water tank for about a week when one of those happens, until the storm passes. There are also huge problems just landing on the surface of Mars. In fact, historically, about half of all missions that we've sent to Mars haven't made it down to the surface. It's incredibly tricky to land successfully on Mars. And once you're on the surface, in addition to the radiation, it's extremely cold on Mars. The average temperature is about minus 58 degrees Celsius. We can't breathe the air. It's almost all carbon dioxide. Liquid water can't exist on the surface. Oh, and if anyone's seen The Martian, they might know that there are global dust storms that can hit you on Mars. They're not quite as bad as in The Martian. Mainly they just block out your solar panels because they block out the sun. But that means you have to ration electricity when one of these storms hits. So there are many unique challenges to be faced on Mars, but I think we can overcome them.
So that's what can go wrong. I guess we should talk about the flip side of this. You're hoping to go up in 2031. What's the end goal for the Mars One project? What are they hoping to get done finally, and when are they hoping to do it by?
So ultimately, Mars One is relatively short-term at the moment. They're looking at sending four people in 2031, four more people 2 years later, and you can send people to Mars roughly about every 2 years or 26 months when the planets are aligned in the right position. So they'd want to keep sending more people until eventually the outpost on the surface of Mars is able to look after itself and produce most of the things that it needs without requiring supplies to be shipped from the Earth. We call that being self-sufficient. But the very, very, very long-term goal would be to attempt something that's called terraforming. What we mean by that is Mars at the moment isn't a nice place. It's very different from the Earth. We know it used to be more like the Earth. So the idea is, could we deliberately modify the climate of Mars to turn it back into a habitable planet where we would be able to walk out the surface and breathe the air without a special spacesuit? So this would be an incredibly ambitious project. It's like the climate change we're doing on the Earth, but deliberately doing that to warm up Mars. And this would take many, many centuries and require a huge dedicated effort with everyone in the world working together to do it. That's the very, very long-term goal. And if we're lucky, that might be done by maybe the 2300s.
So how many people very quickly are going out, hopefully, in the first mission?
There will be four, two males and two females.
For 2 years?
We can send a new crew 2 years later. The first mission will actually... All these missions are one way. You go there, take 7 months to get there, and then you're living in the outpost on Mars for the rest of your life. We don't currently have the technology to get people back from Mars, and that's why we haven't actually sent people yet.
Fingers crossed. I really hope you get there. Thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. We give you our full best wishes. That is, it's Ryan McDonald. Yeah, you need to check out his YouTube channel as well, Martian Colonist, for updates on his adventure. Ryan, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Right, time for today's Dangerous Dan, where we look at the most deadly, mean and cruel things in the universe. And today we're headed deep into the jungle to find the most painful animal in the world. This animal scores 4 points on the Schmidt Sting Pain Index, and scientists use this index to judge and analyse how painful a sting is. And this 4 points is the most of any animal in the world. It's the most painful thing, but its size might surprise you, because it's an ant. The bullet ant is found in the rainforests of Nicaragua and Paraguay. It's jet black with a hint of red. It's about an inch long. They look like thick wingless wasps. It clusters around tropical trees looking for food, and its sting is so painful, it's like being shot. That's what people say, and that's why it's got the name, the bullet ant. Remember that, because this next part is crazy, right? It is used by Brazilian tribesmen as an initiation ceremony to sort out the boys from the warriors. Ants are woven inside of a glove made of leaves, right? And their stingers face the inside of the glove. Then the boys have to put their hands inside as well, with the ants stinging them for 5 minutes. The sting makes them shake, makes them go delirious. It paralyzes their arms, makes them a little bit sick as well. This doesn't just happen once either. It goes on for 20 times over a year. And only then, when they've done that, are the boys accepted into the tribe. So the bullet ant, one of the smallest creatures in the jungle, can turn boys into warriors. So if you've got a science question stuck inside your brain at the moment, stay right there. We'll get an expert to answer it in a sec. First, it's time for one of our favourite series on the show. It features two microbes. They're Benny and they're Mal. Now, microbes are tiny, right? They're little bits of bacteria. You can't really see them. And one day, Benny and Mal, they were in a Petri dish. While the scientist working on them, Professor Hallux, he went off to go and do some work, some more experiments, probably play on his phone. And they were left in the Petri dish for too long. Far too long. And then Benny and Mal, they came to life. They started growing. And now they spend their time searching through the universe, learning new stuff, solving issues. And today they're finding out what is right and what is wrong with science.
Get ready for some brain-teasing fast files with Benny and Mal, with support from the Nuffield Council on Bioethics.
You're right. Benny here.
And I'm Mal. As you know, me and Benny have been having lots of fun imagining all the cool ways we could change our bodies. And it turns out you lot have been doing the same.
That's right. Now, different people will look at things in different ways. Some may think, that's brilliant.
Others, though, may well be a little more unsure.
Yeah, I was getting to that. Okay, right. Against the clock. Who's on the line today?
Hello, my name is Benny. I'd like to be invisible.
Well, this sounds brilliant. Imagine you could get into the cinema for free and watch as many films as you like, go to the zoo without buying a ticket, you could, I don't know, even sleep in the zoo.
Yeah, and if you, like, got captured by Zombie Pirate King and he was going to make you into his slave, you could, like, just totally escape. He'd be like, where has he gone?
Okay. Now, zombie pirate kings are pretty rare, you have to admit. And all that other stuff was basically about breaking the law, wasn't it? Watching movies for free and not paying for a ticket to the zoo.
Good point. You've got me bang to rights there. Yeah, not sure a pro is really a pro if it's doing something naughty. Probably not, actually. And who gets to decide who's going to get the invisibility powers anyway? You wouldn't want the old zombie pirate king to have them, would you?
That would be a very bad thing. Nice one, Benny. Well, unless you were an evil zombie pirate king. It's a brain-busting body bamboozler for sure.
Sure is. Catch you next time.
Brain-teasing Fast Files with Benny and Mal, with support from the Nuffield Council on Bioethics. Find out more at funkidslive.com/Benny and Mal.
You can get more dilemmas with Benny and Mal for free on iTunes, on the Fun Kids app, and over at funkidslive.com. It's time to get one of your questions answered by our expert Tom. Every week he's here, right, to blow your mind with some seriously smart science stuff. Now, if you've got any question at all, doesn't matter how silly it is, if it's about the world, the universe, about nature, about animals, make sure you send it over to my page at funkidslive.com and we'll get it answered. Today, our expert Tom is looking to the sky. Seren, who is 9, has asked, what is Orion the star?
Well, Orion the star is a star. But Orion the constellation, which the star is part of, is made up of lots of stars. And what has happened is, a long time ago, our ancestors looked up at the sky and saw these stars and did a big game of join the dots and made it into Orion the Hunter. That's why it is called Orion.
Where on the world, on our Earth, can we see Orion properly? Because I know that when I'm, you know, at home, looking out the window at night, I can see Orion's belt. That's the three little stars that are almost in a perfect line. Do I have to travel far for me to see the whole of the constellation Orion?
You shouldn't have to travel too far. In the Northern Hemisphere, we can see it very well, actually. The problem is if you're in the Southern Hemisphere and looking out at a different part of the sky, and then Orion isn't present.
And how come the sky always looks the same to us every night or so? Because, for instance, these constellations were first given names because old travellers used to use them to plot their way across the deserts and across land. So that means they must be able to see the same thing, but from different angles. Why is that?
Well, that's because the stars are so far away that any little movement we make makes very little difference in the context of that distance.
So it's almost going to be the same. It's always going to be the same from pretty much wherever we are because we're so far away.
Absolutely. We rotate on the Earth and that does make a difference. But because it's so far away, standing on a different point of the Earth isn't much difference.
Right, let's find out what sciencey stuff has been in the headlines this week. A study of the Amazon rainforest has discovered 381 brand new species. A report by the World Wildlife Foundation found 216 new plants, 93 fish, 32 species of amphibians, 20 of mammals, 19 reptiles, and a single brand new bird species. The job now is to keep them safe. Also, tests of a new transport system using Hyperloop technology has broken a high-speed record by propelling one of its pods to 220 miles an hour. Its creator, Elon Musk, has said that the prototype will help find new ways to travel at great speeds. And finally, a 900-ton block of steel has been moved into position at a port near Liverpool, where it will be fitted onto the RRS Sir David Attenborough ship. Apparently, they've got 85% of the ship ready and made, and this block of steel will be the final piece of the puzzle. Good news, that is. Right, we'll get more science in the news next week. Now it's time to discover how something you use every single day was invented with one of our faves, Sir Sidney McSprocket.
Sir Sidney McSprocket's inspiring inventions in partnership with Weir Group.
The year is 1899. Victorian Britain. The place, Sir Sidney McSprocket's workshop, Edinburgh, Scotland. The time, just before 11s.
Oh, hello, come in, sit yourself down. I'm just putting the finishing touches to my brilliant new invention, toast trimming tongs. Just adjusting the tension on the flywheel here. Oh, now that wasn't supposed to happen. Anyway, not to worry, I'll sort that out later. Welcome, one and all, to another Inspiring Inventions. Thanks. Today we'll be travelling through history to find out about an invention your modern 21st century brains couldn't imagine life without. a computer. A computer is more or less a machine that carries out a series of jobs. So, with the help of my own finest invention, the patented future scrutineer, let's find out how it all started. Just got to start the bellows. Oh, is it me or is it hot in here? Goodness, this worked up a sweat. Right, I'll just program in the details. Computers, tell us all about how it started.
The year is 3000 BC, ancient Babylon. Abacuses were used to do basic calculation. An abacus has rows of beads on wooden bars which can be moved about. It is a simple yet effective way to count quickly.
Computers are all about making life easy, you see.
In the 1200s and throughout the Middle Ages, many machines were invented to perform calculations to measure things such as the movement of the sun and moon. These early machines looked a lot like clocks, but with levers and camshafts. Being able to tell the machine what to do is part of what makes a computer. In 1801, punched paper cards were used for the first time by Joseph Marie Jacquard, who used cards to tell his loom what pattern to weave. Punched cards were used right up to the 1980s in some computers. In 1837, Charles Babbage created the first computer that not only did calculations, but could also be programmed. That's being told what to do. You can still see a version of the engine in the Science Museum in London.
Houston, we have liftoff.
By the 1950s and 60s, computers had become powerful enough to send rockets into space. But the large valves that were needed to give the instructions meant even basic computers took up entire rooms. But transistors changed all that. Small electronic devices that took up a lot less space. You could hold several in the palm of your hand.
And small equals fast and clever where computers are involved.
By the 1980s, tiny silicon chips made it possible for computers to be even smaller, and therefore possible for families to start owning them at home. By the start of the 21st century, the internet covers the entire planet, connecting billions of computers. Computers are everywhere. In cars, mobile phones, washing machines, even road signs.
Amazing stuff. And what more is to come? What might computers look like in the 22nd century?
In the future, it is believed that quantum computers will be the size of atoms, and the number of calculations they can undertake will be astronomical, which means anything you do on a computer, from games to your homework, will be faster and look better and better.
Och, there's a rumbly and matumbly. All this scrutineering makes me hungry. Time for a tea cake. Thanks for joining me. Drop by again soon, won't you?
Sir Sidney McSprocket's Inspiring Inventions is produced by Fun Kids in partnership with Weir Group, creating excellent engineering solutions.
There's loads more inspiring adventures with Sir Sidney on the Fun Kids app, on iTunes, and over at funkidslive.com. And that is it for this week's show. We are back next week with more amazing adventures and brutal beasts from the whole universe in the Fun Kids Science Weekly. And if you want more experiments and science and smart stuff, we've got loads of amazing series absolutely free for you to download and listen to wherever you are, on iTunes, on the free Fun Kids app, and over at funkidslive.com. And that website, by the way, is one of the many places that you can hear Fun Kids all around the country. We're there, we're on DAB Digital Radio, and on the free Fun Kids app.
So- So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB Digital Radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.